Hi there. I'm Dr. Kevin Payne with my friend and co-host Don Peterson, and we're here with episode 4 of the Chronic Life Podcast, Preserving Our Relationships. In this episode, we're going to take a first pass at looking at some of the really difficult emotional things that we go through, either living with a chronic illness or being a caregiver for someone we love with a chronic illness. And one of the things that so many people complain about is that this is really tough. It's really hard on our relationships because it's not what we expect.
Well, it's taking what structure you had within your relationships and all throwing it all into chaos, right? And so you kind of have to reassemble pieces of that, those that, you know, you need to take with you and maybe leave behind some things that maybe you used to do that now with whatever condition you're suffering with, you no longer can do. And that's disruptive. That's, you know, got to be frustrating and disappointing. And, you know, and then of course there's people around you and they don't really know how to act, right? I know that, you know, like people with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, you know, it's just not something you talk about, right?
Right.
I mean, it's embarrassing and, you know, it's not something you're going to talk about over lunch with your friends or,
no.
You know, even at the bar with your buddies. It's just not something that comes up in conversation. But, man, you need an outlet, right? You need somehow to convey to people that I'm hurting or I'm suffering or this is difficult. And, you know, it's just really tough to go through that alone. So I appreciate, I think this is the kind of episode I love doing because it's really about the human side of conditions. And I hope that we get to dive deep into, you know, what are the kinds of things that you can expect and how do we pull ourselves together when this our structure is just broken apart by a diagnosis we weren't expecting.
I expect that we'll end up having several episodes on relationship issues as we go along, and sometimes we'll talk about it, and sometimes we'll bring in various outside experts as well. Today, I want us to really focus on what I'm calling the foundations of a relationship. And it turns out that all human relationships really have three elements in their foundation. And that's trust, respect, and hope. And you have a lot of that if it's a really deep, long-lasting, intimate relationship like a spouse or parents and child. But all human relationships have a little bit of it, at least.
Yeah.
So today we want to talk about trust, respect, and hope and how either living with the ongoing distress of a chronic illness yourself or caregiving changes those things and really attacks those foundations.
What happens to trust? Okay, so if we take this one piece at a time, trust, respect, and hope. You know, we saw people come in to Infusion Express who, you know, I can only theorize. I could never ask this to be sure, but you know, I think our nurses, in many respects, knew more about our patient's condition than sometimes their own family members knew, right?
Yeah.
Or even their spouse. And it was encouraging and gratifying to see that patients trusted our nurses so much that they would share that information, you know, with them. But is that because they're nurses and their care, you know, they're there to provide care that patients will open up when given the opportunity?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is because the nurses have a kind of an official role that they are being caregivers, and you're exactly right. The other thing is there's a little bit of distance there. There's social distance. And often that social distance allows us to have some of those intimate conversations with somebody else because we perceive that there won't be any consequences.
So like social media.
Yeah.
Right.
Like social media, there's something called the online disinhibition effect, which could be a whole thing. It's you know, the strangers on the train phenomena, not that you were going to, you know, do one another's murders for us, but that you will confide something in somebody that you've only just met and that you don't anticipate to, you know, having a deep long-term relationship.
Nobody's going to betray that trust because there's not that familiarity. Is that?
Yeah, and there's not a mutual dependency involved there either. And so there just isn't that kind of consequence. So when we talk about trust, you know, let's kind of define it here. I don't want to get too wonky, but you know, trust is this confidence and reliance that a person will positively deliver as you expect. Okay, so my expectations for, say, a brief interaction with a nurse can be pretty low because it's, you know, I just need to trust that they're going to be able to do their job through, you know, this hour or two of infusion or whatever it is. And so with someone I care about, with someone I depend on, with someone who depends on me, then those standards become really high. And over time, we develop a shorthand in our relationship. You know, I can trust my partner for X, Y, and Z, right? And they may say, oh, I can't trust him for this, but, you know, to take out the trash, but I can trust him for these other things. But with a chronic illness, then maybe as my health waxes and wanes over time, on the outside, it looks like I become more erratic, right?
I'm not sure I get that concept. Why would you become more erratic?
Well, because I may, you know, there's something that if I feel really well, I'm going to go ahead and follow through on, like I always do. And then on another time, you know, I may make that promise and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this for you. But then suddenly I don't feel like it. And it's not that I don't want to. It's that, you know, I can't somehow.
So you're saying that if I were depending on you to do something for me that you had said you were going to do, that's the trust relationship between us. But somehow, sometimes that trust breaks down because you feel like you can't deliver because of your condition or you're not feeling well that day, your plan C day or whatever it is.
Right.
That you said you're going to come over to my house and we're going to, I don't work on something, but now you can't make it.
Mm-hmm. And you may not be, you may not feel like you want to be completely honest about it because you don't want to be perceived as somehow lacking. And that's going to get into the respect part of this as well.
Yeah, so one of the phenomenons I watched at Infusion Express is because most of the people who were getting infusible therapy had to come back every 4 or 6 weeks or, you know, 8 weeks. But we saw them regularly, is that there became such a trust relationship between the patient and a specific nurse who happened to be working in that facility that they kind of developed an attachment to that nurse.
Certainly.
And didn't want another nurse taking care of them. And, you know, one of the things that we did regularly to, and I hate to say it this way, but it's to somewhat control that because it wasn't in our interest, nor did we think it was in the best interest of the patient that they get so attached to a particular nurse that we would rotate our nurses around from facility to facility within a given city to give them the opportunity not only to cross-train and to develop skills within every facility we had, because we wanted to scale, we wanted to grow in, you know, around the country, and so we kind of had to be consistent in our execution of of the operations. And part of that consistency was that any nurse could walk into any facility and take care of patients just as effectively as they could at their home facility, quote-unquote home, because we didn't actually give them a home facility. So they didn't just work in one facility over and over again. But there were arguments made, and I was open to this debate as to whether those relationships that patients, that attachment that patients were developing with our nurses was actually a good thing. Because then, of course, they were loyal to us as a commercial business. We wanted patients to keep coming back, of course. But I was really on the fence on whether or not that was healthy for either party.
Well, you should have been on the fence about it because there are strengths and weaknesses to that model, and you don't want patients to be developing that attachment formation. You want to set them at ease, and you want to make them as comfortable as possible, but you're right. Especially if you're dealing with a patient that has insufficient or inadequate social support in their, you know, life outside of, you know, they're getting their treatments. So there are a lot of issues there. It can go either way. So you're right to be on the fence about it. the trust issues also can happen the other way as well. So if you are, say, a partner or spouse and caregiver for somebody with a chronic condition, they can start losing trust in you because maybe, you know, you were talking about how everything kind of has to be blown up and changed in the relationship. Well, you didn't sign up for this, but now suddenly you may have some additional responsibilities that you didn't have in the relationship beforehand.
You mean as a caregiver or as a patient?
As the caregiver.
Yeah,
as
the caregiver. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so because of that, you know, you're trying to juggle those needs with your other demands. And sometimes you may keep all the balls in the air and sometimes you may not. Now, from the outside, that can be damaging in that trust relationship. You know, if I'm the patient and I'm counting on you to do it and you don't get that done, you know, on the one hand, you know, we realize that there are other things going on in life, but that still, implicitly, we don't have these conversations. So trust is the first part. Second part then is respect, okay? And respect is that esteem and regard that you have for somebody, you know, and the qualities that you value. And so if I have a chronic condition and, you know, maybe there are things, you know, like for me, I do not mow the lawn like I used to. And it's actually really tough. And there's a whole long story here, but it resulted in a really, really bad exacerbation for me one time. And I ended up paralyzed in pain in the middle of the yard.
So you had a negative experience from doing it, so that negativity comes back when you consider doing it again?
Well, no. What I mean is, that's a guy thing that I do around, you know, around the house. And then it was there were a lot of those guy things that I eventually found I couldn't do as regularly or as well as I used to be able to do. That's me losing respect for myself, but that's the people around me, you know, implicitly losing respect for because of their image of me.
Well, this is a little reminiscent of the previous episode when we talked about patient advocacy, right? And advocating for yourself and, you know, what keeps you from speaking up? What keeps you from asserting yourself? And that is, I think you're touching on it right here, is that reduction in your own personal self-esteem or respect, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, I've been victimized by this condition. It has weakened me. So thus, as a weakened person, I don't have the same respect I had for me when I was a strong person.
But I'm not talking about even just me. I'm talking about how spouses and family members start thinking less of you.
Well, think less of you.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I mean, in many cases they do, actually. And,
yeah.
And they don't even realize it. They'll say that they don't, but they actually will. The third part of this is hope. The third part of these foundations that gets attacked is hope. And hope is that belief that there's a future in the relationship and that it's going to be just as good on average as your other options.
Yeah, but that's like saying at the light at the end of the tunnel is not a freight train coming at me, right?
Right.
And you hope that the light is the light and you keep moving towards it expecting it to be the light. And it isn't always.
No, right? It isn't. But we all need to have some kind of reasonable hope to stick with something. When these little things break down in the relationship and in the way things have always been done, you can kind of erode that sense of hope. And so all of these things together are like a bridge that you and another person carry. And you put your experiences together in it and you fill the relationship up with those things. But that's the foundation. And if that starts weakening, if that trust, that respect, that hope start weakening, then
what's holding up the
relationship,
bridge?
Yeah, exactly. Right? The relationship, you know, crumbles apart.
Yeah.
By way of kind of wrapping up this section, and we have these experiences that violate our expectations. You know, our lives are changing in ways that we don't understand. And sometimes we don't communicate and we don't share an understanding of the why on either end. And because of all those things, that trust, respect, and hope can erode. So in the next section, I want us to talk about how these go wrong and what it looks like when they go wrong so that we can recognize it. This is Dr. Kevin Payne with my co-host, Don Peterson, and we're talking about how to preserve our relationships when those foundations of trust, respect, and hope get mangled by the stresses and strains of living with a chronic illness and giving care.
Yeah, I think we are in violent agreement that when, you know, someone in a relationship has been diagnosed, you know, let's say between spouses, with a severe chronic condition, that it fractures everything, right? All the things, the structure that you knew now is thrown up in the air and you've got to rebuild it. And, you know, I guess, you know, if relationships are built around trust, respect, and hope, which I entirely agree with, you know, what kinds of signs are there? What do you see? What are the symptoms of a relationship now that, you know, this diagnosis has been rendered and we all are concerned, but what do you see? How do you feel, you know, as these changes occur in those relationships? How do you recognize that, you know, maybe trust is breaking down or, you know, or something like that, or my self-respect isn't what it used to be and now I'm not the same person anymore?
Right. So one of the first things we see is that our standards for what constitute trust, respect, and hope in the relationship get lowered. So instead of, like, you know, what most of us would recognize as kind of a full-on deep, you know, ride-or-die trust, it's more like predictability. Okay, so at least they're hitting their marks and they're doing what we expect them to do.
Dependability?
Yeah, dependability. It's that sort of thing. Instead of respect, it's deference. You know, it's like, okay, whatever you want. It's, you know, it's deferring to one another instead of really, you know, agreeing and supporting what it is they're doing. Or even if you don't agree with what they're doing, you feeling confident that they have good reasons for it. So it's deference, not respect. It feels different. You'll start feeling those differences. And then empty commitment, not hope. When somebody stops feeling trust or trust starts dropping in a relationship, the best single predictor is criticism goes up. They become more critical. They start harping with the little criticisms here and there.
When you say they start harping,
the other person, the person who is feeling the lack of trust, will start evidencing that with these little criticisms that they didn't used to do, probably. And that is absolutely predictable. So when we hear those criticisms in the interaction, we know that there's a drop in trust in that relationship. So if you're criticizing me, then there's a characteristic reaction that you're almost always going to see.
Yeah.
I'm going to become more defensive.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Right. So the person who's losing the trust shows the criticism. The person who's feeling less trustworthy, you know, in the relationship is being defensive about it. Whoa, wait a minute. Likewise, when you've got somebody who is losing their sense of respect in a relationship, they tend to exhibit contempt. So when you see someone being contemptuous, when they're belittling what that other person is doing or trying to do, not the criticism, but actually the belittling it, downplaying it, like it's not worthy, that's a sign of a lack of respect.
Does it really go that far? I guess, you know, that contempt word sounds really strong and negative. You know, I guess I would have maybe used the word, and I'd be wrong about this. You know, you're the sort of the social psychologist, so you know what you're talking about. I only see it from my perspective, and I think of it as maybe just a little bit of resentment.
Okay,
it's so not, does it go that far as contempt? I mean, yeah, resentment?
I'm just going to go ahead and note for our audience that our female engineer over here was saying, oh, yeah, it goes that far. And I'm going to emphasize that because this is most, this, and the reason why you don't see it as much is because this is largely a gendered thing. So in a heterosexual relationship, men tend to lose trust before respect. Women tend to lose respect before trust. So the driver tends to be trust for men. Oh, she's cheating on me or whatever it is, you know. And it tends to be respect for women.
So how does that manifest itself? I mean, I understand that what you're saying, there's a difference there. But as we were talking about, if your lack of respect swings you all the way to contempt for someone that maybe you've been with a long time that you care about, isn't there a middle ground? There's no middle ground.
Remember, it's always a continuum.
Okay.
You're going in that direction. You're going in that direction. When you get to the contempt, when you get to full-blown, unmitigated contempt, you're getting divorced.
Yeah,
no, I mean that's sure. I mean that's where you're going, but then there's the person who is feeling the contempt has a characteristic response too,
mm-hmm.
and it's stonewalling. So that's, you know, it's putting up the bluster and the, oh yeah, you know, this is a good thing, I'm doing this, I've got reasons, I've, you know, they're stonewalling, they're trying to shut down any kind of conversation that's happening because all that they're getting is the expression of contempt.
Right. Well, I would shut it down too. Yeah. I mean, if we were sitting here and you showed contempt for me, well, of course I'm going to shut down. Why would I speak again, right? Because if all I do or say is just going to engender your contempt, then I'm going to quit volunteering to be held in contempt by you, right?
Yeah, and what I'm saying though is that, you know, that criticism and defensiveness and contempt and stonewalling, those are obvious signs that we can use to recognize something going, one of these dynamics going on in our relationship. Okay? So the third one then is a lack of hope. And when somebody lacks hope in a relationship, they tend to evidence that by being distant or disengaged with the other person. And so when you start seeing that distance, that's a behavioral manifestation of that lack of hope, okay? And we have a characteristic way of responding to that. We eventually, we stop planning. We stop playing out, you know, these future scenarios in our head. We start feeling that fear of missing out. You know, it's like, oh, I could be doing something else that would be, you know.
I think I've heard a similar description made of, like, kids that grew up in the ghetto who've lost hope, right?
Right.
They fail to dream, right? They can't think beyond the four walls or the square block or whatever it is because, you know, to think bigger than their hopes allow is only going to be disappointing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying it's a kind of a similar thing.
Right. It is.
You've shrunken your world down to this little patch. You're still on it, but the light at the end of the tunnel in your mind, it's a freight train coming at you.
It's a freight train, and you're looking at going some in a different direction.
Getting off the track.
Right.
Right.
Right. So these are all really common relationship dynamics, and we want to learn to recognize these practical signs as early as possible. And one of the frustrating things is we don't realize that we've mistaken predictability for trust and deference for respect and that empty commitment for hope. And so we keep hanging in there doing the wrong things, you know?
Well,
we get frustrated when they don't work right.
Right. But I got to believe, and, you know, in long relationships, like my wife and I have been married for 40 years, there's a certain assumption of trust, respect, and hope that we've embraced these last 40 years through raising three children and, you know, moving across the country in different jobs and, you know, the things that each of us have personally been through, you know, we've been there for each other. And I can imagine that if something were to change, some major diagnosis or something would disrupt our world, that, you know, things would be fractured and would need to be rebuilt. But I believe that, you know, for at least a while, we would continue to have mutual trust, respect, and hope.
Yeah, it doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
It doesn't happen overnight.
But I think these signs are important because I can see how, you know, with one of us perhaps being diagnosed with a severe condition and the other not, right? Imagine, you know, at my age and her age, we're going to be sailing into the sunset one of these days in retirement. And we want to go travel and do what we have all these plans, like you were talking about. And one of us gets disrupted with a major medical problem and all those plans get, well, shelved. And that, yeah, sure, that can change a relationship, right?
What if you're both dealing with chronic illnesses? And so you're both, you know, in many couples nowadays, it's not just one person with a condition. It's you're both trying to trade off roles of caregiving and being cared for.
Well, but that's part of being together,
well,
right?
It is,
I mean, that's what we signed up for.
One of the challenges we all face is that some of us go into relationships having really good models. So we've got, you know, like my parents, despite their problems, have been married almost 60 years. By golly, they know how to do it.
Well, or you just keep testing it every day, right?
Right, and you do. You know, it always is.
It's an iterative process.
It is, and it's always a learning process. Other people never grow up seeing that.
True.
And they don't have those kinds of tools. This really, they don't have any context for this sort of thing. You know, when you're really distressed, you tend to fall back on, you know, what I call your inner cave child. And it's the stuff you learned as a kid and that set the baseline for your way of seeing the world. And it's the stuff that goes back to our deepest ancestral heritage. And none of those are really good strategies for dealing with distress in the long term.
No, I don't know that there's, you know, I suppose there is on your clinical side, there are good strategies or reasonably well-known strategies for handling things as disruptive as a, you know, severe medical diagnosis. But, you know, everybody's condition, everybody's situation is unique to them, and their ability to deal with it is going to, well, it's going to cover some spectrum, right? It's not going to be, right, this is the best way to do it or that's the worst way to do it. It's just, this is the best way I know how to do it, right?
Right.
And this is where I think Chronic Cow and your book really is helpful, is that it brings understanding to the things that we're going to go through. This is why this is such a great episode, because we're talking about, you know, the underlying sort of words and motivations you have and the disruptive factors that environment can be to a relationship, mm-hmm, right? Because that's really all that changed. Something outside of you that you had no control over has changed everything.
One thing that I want to emphasize is that this is where a lot of frustration and resentment can build up, because, you know, I can be over here trying my best, and I'm really trying it, but if I'm doing the wrong things, if we're not doing, because there's a relatively short list of things that you need to do in order to fix any kind of relationship, and if you're working really hard at the wrong stuff, it's still not going to turn out the way you want. And so you can get really frustrated and resentful, and that just makes everything worse, and it spirals this sort of experience.
Well, let's take a short break.
We all have challenges. Mine is multiple sclerosis. We each have this one life, and we didn't choose to be saddled with chronic illness. But there's a better way. So I choose to Just Jump. And you can too. It's your life. Live it well. ChronicCow.com.
Welcome back. I'm Don Peterson, here with my co-host, Dr. Kevin Payne. And we are talking about relationships and how those relationships can be altered by a chronic diagnosis, and what to look for in terms of those relationships, the basis of those. You know, we talked about trust, respect, hope, and Kevin helped us define the things that we should notice as our relationships evolve, that that maybe things have changed a little bit. But let's talk now, you know, about how we reconstruct, how we get things back together so that we're not allowing this diagnosis to long-term disrupt the relationships with the people we care most about.
Yeah, so you know, somewhere we've noticed that maybe the criticism, defensiveness, the contempt and stonewalling, that disengagement and fear of missing out has kind of crept in. And I know this is going to be it's going to sound like a truism, but at this point, you've got to communicate. you really have to. And that doesn't mean just shouting at each other, and it doesn't mean that you're presuming. Because here's one thing that, especially long-term couples, I'll give you an example here. So we do this thing called the attribution process. So in other words, every time somebody does something around us that we see, our little mental model inside, we're saying, oh, this is why he did that, or this is why she did that.
Yeah, we're attributing motives, right? Why do they think that? Why do they say that? We do this to ourselves all the time, right? And sometimes we have no clue. We're just speculating of the time.
Right. It's called the attribution process, yeah. And really it can be either a state or a trait attribution, and then it can be an external attribution. So we're always doing this. Now, how accurate do you think we are at the attribution process? So let's say a long-term couple who've known each other for years and lived with each other, and it turns out those people are the very best at making attributions. How often do you think they'd be right?
Oh, probably rarely. You know, maybe 5% of the time or 10.
Well, okay, so you're a little more pessimistic than we are.
I've known my wife for a long time, been married to her for 40 years, and it would be great if I could read her mind, but I can't.
Yeah.
And so you learn to stop trying. Right?
You've got to ask.
And you ask. It's like, well, why did you say that? Or why are you reacting that way? We had a conversation in the car the other day, and we were 10 minutes down the road, and she said, so you agree with me, right? And I go, well, at this point, I have no choice because I'm locked in the car with you for another 15 minutes. And I don't want to have an argument with you about this. But the way you've made these statements, I only have a choice of agreeing with you, because if I disagree, I know we're going to argue about this. And I think the time we've had together, we've learned to sort of stop trying to anticipate what the other is thinking, mm-hmm. and just freaking ask.
Right. Humans have something called theory of mind. That's another technical term. And it means that we try to put ourselves in other people's perspective and think how they think and everything. That's called perspective taking. And it turns out we suck at it. What we need to do is what's called perspective getting.
Okay, but you didn't tell me how good I was at 5 or 10%. Is that good?
No, actually, I mean...
How far off was I?
The very best couples will get almost half.
Oh, okay. That's pretty good.
Yeah. But that is... And so literally think about this. All the times we do this, each of us, every day, you know, when we interact with other people... And we're presuming, oh, this is why they're doing what they're doing. And just realize, at best, under the best circumstances, you might be right in your guess half the time.
Well, and imagine, so this is, again, I could get political, but I don't want to. And it's not politics. It's about social media. I can only imagine how bad we would be at assigning or attributing motive or what somebody's thinking to a tweet. I mean, mm-hmm. I think this is where social media goes wrong, right? we write it or we read it and we go, oh, he meant this. No, that's not what he meant. No, no. There's no inflection. There's no, you know, inference to be made here. You have no idea what I was thinking or what motivated me. Yeah, maybe I chose my words poorly or I didn't choose my words poorly. Maybe I said exactly what I wanted to say, but you would have no clue. And so don't ascribe a motive to me that you have no clue about. But I have a rule, and I don't follow it all the time. I try very hard never to send an emotional text or email or post anything emotionally because I know it's not going to come through properly.
Yeah,
I'm just going to make people angry or frustrated or pissed off or whatever, and there's no point doing that. There's nothing to be gained by that. And I think that's true in any relationship. You got to stop and say, I don't know what's motivating you to say that. Help me understand.
Right. That's why every year they add hundreds of emojis to, you know, to try to capture some of those paralinguistic and non-linguistic cues that we get. Obviously, it doesn't do it.
Yeah. And so I tell people around me, if you want me to understand you, come and talk to me. Mm-hmm. You know, worst case, call me on the phone. But don't write it to me and expect me to understand what you're really thinking.
So that is the first thing here. Just understand that no matter how good you think you are, you suck at forming these attributions. And you have to talk about it. We fear that we may be disapproved of or argued with or somehow thought poorly of. It doesn't matter. You just have to do it. And you have to realize that the communication is that important.
And these are all relationships. You mentioned, you know, the cisnormal sort of heterosexual relationship
right.
between men and women. I think it transcends
every
sex,
human, yes.
Transcends politics, transcends religion. If we all just communicated more openly, we asked more questions. This is going back to the podcast we did on advocating for yourself with your doctor. Just be honest. Just say, Doc, yes. I don't understand this. Can you help yes. me better understand this? Same thing you would ask your wife or your husband or your boyfriend, your girlfriend or whatever it is you have. Help me understand why you would say that.
Yeah. And you have to understand that all of the apprehension you feel is far worse than what's actually going to be there.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I asked my daughter the other day to help me edit a paper I wrote. It was just 3 pages or something. And you could tell she didn't want to say anything to me about what was in the paper. She corrected a few punctuation mistakes and spelling mistakes I made. I said, well, how did you feel about the way this sentence was structured? Or did I get my thought across the right way? She said, I can't weigh in on that. I'm like, well, why not? She was an English major. She's a certified copywriter. I mean, she knows what she's doing technically, but I wanted her point of view as well. And she said, Dad, I feel like you're helping me with my algebra homework from ninth grade. She said, I feel like I really can't criticize the content. I'm like, oh, well, I guess maybe I in the past have been unwilling to accept your input, and I'm sorry if I did that. But feel free. She said, oh, you'll just be offended. And I said, well, don't assume I'll be offended, but yeah, that's one of the responses. Maybe I could be offended by it. You know, and maybe, or ask me to explain it to you, then tell me whether or not the words I used were appropriate. Mm-hmm. But I think we do that to people and in relationships, is we put them at a distance, or we have conditioned them to have a specific response when we ask a question
right.
or make a statement, right?
And that is absolutely true. Everything we do is conditioned and, to the degree possible, habituated.
Yeah,
and we try to push everything down to that level to operate, you know, easily and efficiently as much as we can, and a lot of our relationships are on autopilot
yeah.
because of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to communicate. A second thing that we have to do is we have to renegotiate our responsibilities and our contributions to the relationship. So you have to be really honest by saying, okay, this is really difficult for me to do now. What is something I could do for you that you would find beneficial that fall within my limitations?
Yeah.
Or is there something as a caregiver that you're really uncomfortable doing that maybe we could find a way to delegate to somebody else, you know, to get out of our dynamic?
Well, I remember when my wife was diagnosed with her cancer, and I would ask her every day, maybe multiple times a day. I was kind of unconscious. How are you feeling? And I meant it. I mean, I really wanted to understand how she was feeling. And she looked at me one day, late in the day, and I think she was having a tough day, and she looked at me and she said, please stop asking.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want me to tell you how I'm really feeling. I go, well, no, I do. No, she said, no, you don't. No, you really don't. She said, because there's nothing you can do about it anyway, right? And I'm entitled to feel the way I want to feel, and there's nothing you can do about it. I'm just going to make you sad because you're going to get frustrated. You're a problem solver. You're going to want to fix it for me, and I know you can't.
All I can say to that is amen, because I have felt exactly that way so many times.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel put on the spot.
Yeah.
When somebody says, how are you feeling today?
Right.
It's like, oh, really? You really don't want to know, and I don't want to share that with you.
Right, or you just give you the paid answer. I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm okay. I'm good. I'm good.
And it's you know, I don't want to lie, but it's not that I want to hide the truth. It's just there's nothing that can be gained.
Well, I think part of it is we've taken the phrase "how you doing" or "how are you," and we've made it cliche.
Mm-hmm.
We ask it as a small talk. We don't really care. But when you get in a relationship and something disrupts it, like a diagnosis, like a chronic disease, you really do want to know, right? I really wanted to know how my wife was feeling, but I could see in her when she told me that she was just weary of everybody asking her. And at that point, I was just one of everybody. Mm-hmm. I wasn't just her husband for 30 some years. And I could tell she was just kind of worn out. Like you said,
yeah.
I'm worn out. I don't want to answer that question again. And I could understand that. Mm-hmm. So I refrained. But at some point, I wanted to say, well, when can I ask you again? Because I don't want you to think I don't care.
Right. But that's a really good question to ask her.
Yeah.
You know, that's say, when is this all right?
Yeah.
And have that conversation. Because it's not like we don't want to share it with you. It's just not always, right?
Well, or I don't ever ask, right? And then she thinks, well, you don't care.
Right.
Right. So there's this sort of Euclidean line between hero and goat, right?
Yeah.
You're on this side of the line, you're the hero, and on that side of the line, you're the goat. And you really just don't know which side of the line you're on a lot of the times. Right?
Exactly. And that's why you just have to communicate and you just can't presume. A third thing that we can do when we're in this circumstance is we have to give one another opportunities to rebuild. And that means you have to be really explicit about it. You have to sit down and say, okay, these are the things that I feel like I'm not getting out of the relationship right now, and that this is something that would make me feel better, would make me feel more trustworthy or respectful or hopeful or, you know, whatever it is. And frame it in those terms and say, and then what can I do for you so that you're getting what you need? Because one of my pet peeves are caregivers who are only willing to give what they're willing to give rather than asking, what do you need? And then maybe coming to some kind of negotiation in there, right? Because both, you know, it's important that both of them, but if somebody keeps giving something that I don't want or maybe even see as harmful, then that doesn't help our relationship at all.
When does it become okay? When is it okay for a caregiver to be sort of give tough love to someone who maybe has lost their own? We talked about, you lose your own respect, right? You think of yourself as a weakened person. You're not as dependable as used to be, not as predictable as you used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, as a sports kind of guy, I love pep talks, right? Mm-hmm. And there were times when I wanted to give my wife a pep talk and say, honey, you're going to get through this. We're going to, we're going to come out the other end of this thing. We're going to, and is there an appropriate point for that? Is there an appropriate way to do that?
Yeah, and that's really crucial because, most of the time when you bring that up, they already realize. We already realize that something is wrong. We may not know exactly, but we know something is wrong. So my suggestion is that before it ever becomes an issue, you sit down and have these pre-conversations and say, look, there's some difficult things that may happen. in our relationship because of this diagnosis. And it may be something that's really intimate and maybe even humiliating. You may need help toileting and some of these other, you know, really difficult things. And so I need us to maybe even have, it's like we're practicing an alternative lifestyle, and you need a safe word that you're setting up beforehand, and you're saying, you know, whatever that word is, that means I'm seeing something that I think we need to have a painful conversation about, because I love you and I want to support you, and we need to have this.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've read other authors talk about, you know, relationships this way, and how when trust breaks down, respect breaks down, how that creates resentment, you say contempt, and how that goes, how it takes that relationship off the rails, mm-hmm. and hard to climb back once you get off the track.
It truly is, no matter how much you know. And the fourth of these major things that we can do is, you know, I want to hit this one before we take a next break here, is we have to extend one another some grace. You know, I love the concept of grace. It is something that warms my heart, and it's not just a religious concept. It's something that we need to extend one another as humans, as all too fallible humans. And
yeah,
we've got to be able to do that for one another.
Now, it's a spiritual thing, whether it's a specific religious thing or not. Grace, I think, is a form of faith that we'll get through this. I need to extend you grace or time or whatever manifestation that is to help heal this wound or get this problem back on track. And so let's take a short break. And when we come back from break, we'll talk about some takeaways from all of these great topics that we've discussed today.
And this is Dr. Kevin Payne and Don Peterson back once more to kind of give you some final thoughts on this issue of how the foundations of our relationships can be stressed and tested through the ongoing process of living with chronic illness or giving care, and the ways that we can recognize those stresses earlier and what we can do about them whenever they do occur. Any kind of distressing event that you go through, and you know, certainly living with a chronic illness is one of those things, but any other kind of stressful event that you might go through in life with people you care about is not just an invitation, it's a demand to speak more honestly with one another. You just have to assume that those things are going to happen, and when they do, you've got to communicate better. And you don't always have to practice active listening and all of those other, you know, yada, yada, yada techniques. But those are the times that demand that you spend more effort paying attention, and that you're more engaged, and that you're more involved, and really listen and really be aware of what someone's trying to communicate to you. Because, you know, most of the time we're in the back of our head planning what we're going to respond as somebody is communicating to us. And just don't.
Well, I think it's human nature. I know, as you know, I guess a masculine male, that, you know, if something happened to my wife, my first response is to protect her. Mm-hmm. Right? If a problem were to arise, my job is to solve the problem and make it better for her. Right. And you know, I think anybody in a relationship has to presume or assume that position when someone they care about has been hurt. And, you know, we see these diagnoses as a cut, right? It's a slice away at somebody we care about. And, well, of course we want to fix it, you know. And so sometimes we don't listen. We don't know, because we can't solve the medical problem. So maybe we try to solve every other problem, or we try to solve other problems that may not be important to the person you're trying to serve. And so you get this sense inside of you that I've got to do something.
Because that's the way you demonstrate your worth, and that's the way you demonstrate your love. So here is the one thing that you and I and everybody else who has that kind of inclination needs to do. The first thing out of your mouth is support or solve. I'm going to ask you, is this a conversation for support or to solve something?
Good point.
Or the other. Because it's always going to be one or the other.
You're right. I think that guys, especially stoic males, tend to want to solve and not understand what support really even means, right? And sometimes what I've read is that the women just want to vent a little bit and have you support their reaction to whatever it is they're venting about.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And that's it. You have to ask, and you have to remember that even though if you have this reaction that you want to jump in there and fix things, this is not about you.
Yeah.
It's about them and what they need. And that's going to change. I mean, sometimes it's the person who has the chronic illness. Sometimes it's the caregiver. But whoever it is, they're the one who gets to drive. They get to make that choice at that time. Is this an interaction where it's about supporting one another and building our connection and making us feel safe and reducing threat level and emotions and things like that? Or is this a planning session where we're going to figure out how to solve something?
Right, but I think that when something breaks the way we talked about, you know, when you get diagnosed, it destroys or disrupts or disassembles an existing relationship and, you know, you want to rebuild it. Is there a normal or is there a new normal? Do we ever get back? I think that's what we all want, right? When something breaks, we want to put it back, right? We want the glue to, the pieces to fit together and the glue to be invisible and nobody to ever recognize that plate was broken. Does it get there? How does it get there?
Well, no, it doesn't get there. It will never get there. And what's more, even if you don't live with this kind of distress over 5 years, 10 years, 20 years of knowing somebody, your relationship is far more different than you think it is from the beginning. You see what I mean? I mean, there's always these changes going on over time, but when we see this kind of cataclysmic event, our inclination is to let's try to rebuild it the way it was and not allow that this is just going to be a change, and it's happening quicker than it normally does in a relationship over time.
But we have to assimilate it into the relationship.
We do. Okay. And we have to really think about, well, what are the values that I'm getting out of it, and are there different ways to get to those similar values, right? You just can't presume things will ever go back to normal and that you can fix them. And that shouldn't be your goal. Your goal should be to find the good in what's now before you.
Oh, but I back to my earlier point, I think it's human nature that when you break something, you want to put it back to
obviously,
what it was, right?
Obviously.
Unbroken. Yeah. And, oh, by the way, it was never broken in the first place, but, you know, it did break. And it's all back together now, and everything's cool, and we're great. Let's move on and move on to the next event.
So there's this wonderful Japanese art form where it's called wabi-sabi, and it's where they take a pot or saucer or something that has been broken and they piece it back together and they revel in its beauty despite its imperfections. And we really have to look at our relationships in that way, that life comes along and some awful things happen and we get broken. And if we're fortunate and we work hard and we communicate, then it makes us stronger. And we are knitted back together, not in the way that we were, but with our broken imperfections on display. And that's okay. That's human.
No, that's a new concept to me. Wabi-sabi.
Mm-hmm. And the last thing here is, and we've kind of intimated this before, but and this will be kind of a teaser for a future episode of some kind that will come down the line. Everything that we've talked about with these relationships and these challenges to having these relationships, the trust and the respect and the hope, apply to your relationship with yourself. And we actually do. We construct a relationship with ourselves just the same as we construct it with other people. We think we know more because we're inside our head but we actually are using the same processes pretty much. And so you can lose trust and respect and hope in yourself, either as someone with a chronic condition or as a caregiver, right? And you have to work on your relationship with yourself in these same ways too.
Well, I find myself doing it all the time. I tend to worry about things, and I know I tell myself over and over again, worry won't change the outcome. But, you know, it's one of those things I lay down at night and I think about things that I probably should just put out of my mind because I can't change them by thinking about them. But maybe for me, it's more like I'm preparing myself for whatever outcome occurs. So I'm playing those scenarios out in my head. And I know when I've had medical challenges, you know, I play out, how is this going to turn out for me? How is this going to work out? How am I going to deal with this particular problem or that problem? And when will I see the end of it? And I, you know, I guess that's why this is such an interesting topic to me, that in the world of chronic conditions, the way you talk to yourself has to change, because, well, maybe there is no cure. Maybe there's no end. Maybe this is just a lifelong battle or a lifelong condition that you have to tell yourself you're going to get through. It's going to change the quality of your life, but it doesn't have to change the arc of your life, right?
No, and, you know, I can certainly say that in my personal journey, the challenges with relationships that have come out of living with a chronic condition and being a caregiver have in many ways been more brutal than the condition itself. And so I know this is something that we'll keep coming back to. But look at those signs of trust, respect, and hope, and what happens, and communicate and deal with these things early, even though you may not want to. And be kinder to yourself and to the people you love. Now, Don, if you'd close us out by saying just one little bit about our next episode with our cool first guest.
Thanks, Kevin. This was really interesting for me, and I've learned a lot myself just sitting here and having a discussion with you. Next episode, we have Modern Health, M-O-D-R-N, health.com. Caressa Hutchinson, who is its CEO and founder, is going to come and talk about care coordination. And we talked an episode or so ago about patient advocacy, and they have a solution for helping people who are dealing with the healthcare system deal with every aspect of it, from your providers to your caregivers to your insurance company and everybody in between. So it's an interesting interview, and look forward to doing that in the next episode.
I'm really looking forward to it, too.
All right.
Join us on social and continue the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Chronic Life Pod, or go to our website, chroniclifepodcast.com. Until next time, go forth, be well, do well, and do good.